Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. All right, we are in paper 55, section 7, which is old single column, page 631. Okay, so we've finally gotten to the last block of sections in this paper, long paper. Like we've been hinting at many times, with the augmentations and whatnot that they've given us, prior to this section, they've been basically talking about how things progress through the ages of light and life, essentially just totally as an individual planet, phenomenon. It's just the context of the world itself and moving forward. But one of the things they haven't mentioned as you begin to move deeper into those planetary stages of light and life, you will begin to overlap with a macro cosmos, if you will, a larger scale settling in light and life. First, the whole local system, all roughly 1,000 worlds when all is said and done. Then, long time down the road some more, eventually you're going to have a constellation settled in light and life, and then the local universe, etc., as you move up the hierarchy. Each time that greater context that world exists in is settled in light and life, there is a modification of what's going on with that world. They didn't really touch upon that issue. One of the obvious reasons is, it's going to happen at various points in the planetary sequence of light and life stages. It all depends on, if it's a planet that's very early in the game, they're going to be well in the seventh stage of light and life before anything in a greater context is settled. But they might be the last world, right? Say in the local system to get settled, and so then they're not so far along at all by the time things start happening in a bigger context. So now, as a parallel thing, they're going to step us through those bigger stages. But they're going to start with the planetary again, in that context of these bigger stages. Just a few more general statements about the character of what's going on, or the quality of what's going on just the world itself. So you can see that's the title of this first section we're going to be doing in this new hierarchical sequence. So let's jump in and see what we've got here.
Section 7, the first or planetary stage. This epoch extends from the appearance of the Maruncha Temple at the new planetary headquarters to the time of the settling of the entire system in light and life. This age is inaugurated by the Trinity Teacher Sons at the close of their successive world missions, when the Planetary Prince is elevated to the status of Planetary Sovereign by the mandate and personal presence of the Paradise Bestowal Son of that sphere. Concomitant therewith, the Finaliters inaugurate their active participation in planetary affairs.
Okay, now see, basically all the facts that they've given you in that little summary paragraph we've already touched upon, but they're repeating them because they want you to think about those issues in this new, greater hierarchical context. This is how the Planetary Sovereign starts out. What becomes of the Planetary Sovereign as you get a system settled in light and life, and then a constellation, etc. Okay. So that's why they're giving you what seem to be, just repeat details, but they want them re-highlighted in this new context. And then also just appreciating, like I said, you know, before we were just talking about a planet gets settled in the first stage, and it, you know, and finally it ends up in the seventh stage, and it just goes on and on in the seventh stage indefinitely. Right? But you know, in the bigger context, that purely planetary stage will come to an end, you know, at some point, and it's going to be a world that's in an entire system that's settled. See, that's the other little thing that they've added there. You know, just thinking about when that would be and how, you know, so, you know, if that happens before a world gets to the seventh stage, those later planetary stages would be of a different nature than a world that goes through those later stages when, you know, their system isn't settled yet. Right? So there's all of this relativity. You know, in order to make the completeness of supremacy, you have to have every variation you can think of. Right? Those, you know, hardly getting going at all, you know, with their planetary stages when the whole system is settled, and some who are way, way, way deep in the sevens before the system is settled, and everything in between, and all these different variations. You know, You see the key players they're mentioned. You've got the Trinity Teacher Sons, you know, are going to play ongoing roles. Because what we're going to see is more and more the Trinity-type administration of the super universe is going to be penetrating down the hierarchy, right? And eventually, you know, you will have a fully, not just from side to side, but from top to bottom, Trinity administration of the universe of universes. And so you're moving away from, you know, having initial differential of, you know, a threefold character coming from the universal Father, the eternal Son, and the infinite Spirit. You know, more and more it's moving away from that to being a domain that's dominated by that fourth fact, the Paradise Trinity. Because after all, what's happening here? You know, we know you start with, you know, the Trinity's domain of the central universe, especially Havona, part of the central universe, and we're just going to expand that outward to, you know, to fill the whole super universe level with that Trinity footprint. So, in that sense, it's not just the Father that's an initiator, right? I mean, all three existential beings are, to a degree, initiators. But it's all moving eventually to being dominated by that one facet of deity, the only facet of deity that directly engages the totality of reality, that directly engages infinity as a triunity. You know, it's only the Paradise Trinity. So, you know, you're sort of, you know, the Trinity is reaching down, and those influences coming from the three existential persons, you know, is lifting things up, and eventually the two meet. And that's what we're trying to achieve. And then those existential initiating influences move outward, right, to new territory. Their work, you know, basically is done once the Trinity is able to fully interface with the reality, you know, of the domain. You know, when deity and reality have come into full synchronization. Right? So it's this long, slow process of trinitization, if you will, right, of these domains. All right. So you got the Trinity Teacher Sons, you got the Planetary Sovereign, mentioning, of course, the Bestowal Son of the World, you know, kicks things off. And then, of course, the Finaliters, again, who've taken an oath to the Paradise Trinity. Right. So, yeah, that's the basic issue. All right, what else do they say here?
To outward and visible appearances, the actual rulers or directors of such a world settled in light and life are the material son and daughter, the planetary Adam and Eve. The finaliters are invisible, as also is the prince sovereign, except when in the Maurantia temple. The actual and literal heads of the planetary regime are therefore the material son and daughter. It is the knowledge of these arrangements that has given prestige to the idea of kings and queens throughout the universe realms. And kings and queens are a great success under these ideal circumstances, when a world can command such high personalities to act in behalf of still higher but invisible rulers.
Okay, a couple things in there. First things first in the paragraph. Right, we saw that before as they were going through the planetary stages, right, the material son and daughter being continuing to be the real spear point of the administration because they're immediately tangible, visible beings. You know, so they're reminding you of that. So again, it's like we actually already know that, but they want to be thinking of them in this bigger context. And they're giving you some of these things we wondered about a little bit. I mean, we know the finaliters are not going to be visible, but we also know they mentioned that you've got a fully actualized genetic potential through all of the selective breeding and genetic engineering and fullness of scientific understanding and everything as you enlighten life. Remember how they mentioned that immediately and directly you can. All the mortals can see the secondary midwares. Remember how they mentioned that? But remember, the key thing was, it wasn't just an internal thing. It also has to do with a new presence that the master physical controllers, have established on that world. The combination of what what a mortal is in that sort of an age, and this sort of. Augmentation, intermediary phenomenon with the master physical controllers. You can see, apparently some of the lower beings, but notice again that environment thing. So in general, you can't see something as high as a Lindana deck, unless the environment is made all the more augmented, right? In the confines, in the context of the temple. The Lenonidex sun is sovereign, planetary sovereign is visible. So that's indicating there's some, difference from place to place in this presence that the master physical controllers have. Right? They're making it thicker, in some way. They're in the environs of the temple. So the sovereign is visible. And, who knows, they don't give us the details about all the intermediary sort of beings. Well, what about seraphim and cherubim and what have you? I mean, who knows? But in some way, one would think that in certain circumstances, all those lower beings are visible. If, at the very least within the temple, right? I mean, if the Lenonidek is visible in the temple, all the ones that are kind of between secondary midwares and Lenonidex would be visible, somewhere, somehow. Okay, so like I've mentioned a number of times, that you can basically kind of think of, setting aside these complexities, that the mortals are kind of like an Adam and Eve, being able to see all the lower beings, so that at least in some circumstances they can interact with them directly. Right? Okay, but you're always going to need some sort of a fancy visualization thing if anyone's going to see finaliters. Okay, let's see. And then, let's see what else we have there. So then they throw in this whole bit about kings and queens. There's an obvious, parallel. You just think about our world, even with the rebellion and the default. So that we didn't have, the Adam and Eve for very long as a visible phenomenon. Nevertheless, it spawned a tradition of, initially you've got some sort of god mythology that has a male and a female, you know, Osiris and Isis, or, you know, or what have you, you know, that is coming down from the memory of Adam and Eve. But then that also feeds into the concept of kings and queens, you know, that whole, ruling by divine right sort of idea, right? I mean, they're just reminding you, you think you had that on your world. Imagine what it's like on a normal world. You know, how much that would be augmented, you know, in those early stages when you still have monarchies, you know, before things, you know, evolved to representative government, you've got an Adam and Eve that are just this archetype pair that you know, everyone is going to be emulating. You know, so kings and queens, you know, on the order of Adam and Eve, you know, mimicking Adam and Eve on those worlds would be really, popular thing. Very intriguing thing, right? And so that's what they're referring to. And so you very much, you know, are thinking, well, my king and queen, you know, need to be obeyed because they're really a downstepped expression of Adam and Eve, you know. They're really serving in the place of that Adam and Eve, and, you know, and we all know we respect, our material son and daughter, and so, you know, you have that prestige that, you know, a king and queen would have on a normal world.
Isn't the implication that these kings and queens are still ruling in the first age of life?
No, they're not.
You sure?
Because, you know, you grow out of monarchies. I mean, you got to combine it with what you know about the evolution of civilization, right? You leave behind monarchies, you know, at a relatively early stage, but you know, I mean, definitely for, you know, let's say 25,000 years of the post-Adamic age, right? There's going to be a lot of kings and queens stuff. You know, still going to be lots of countries that are ruled by monarchies.
Right, and they're not like Henry VIII. Putting their wives in prison.
Obviously. And see, and that's, of course, the point, is trying to challenge, every time they get a chance, they try to challenge us to not judge things by the most debased, minimalistic example that you can think of. But, you know, which is, you know, most examples on this planet, you know, but
it's all we have.
But, right, but, you know, all these things, you know, I mean, there's such a difficulty of communicating truth to us. You know, they can't even really say father to us. It's like, well, I'm not going to believe in a God as a father because, you know, my father beat me and, you know, and fathers are horrible. It's like, no. A real father, a true father, not the most debased expression you can think of fatherdom. The lesser doesn't define the greater. The lesser is a downstepped expression of the greater. Maybe very, very downstepped and hardly there anymore, right? But nonetheless, right? Trying to challenge you to view things from the top down instead of the bottom up. Because if you don't do that in these little things, you're not going to do it in the biggest thing. You're never going to get an idea of God that isn't anything but just some crude anthropomorphic exaltation, right? Unless you start doing this. Right, that's why from the first paragraph in the book to the last sentence in the book, you know, they're telling you, okay, it's time to address your ideas of God. And we're talking to those who have some vague, valid recognition of the ideal of God, but there isn't a one of you that have anything but the most horrendous idea of God. Right, and you need to just erase all of your ideas of God and start from scratch with something worth talking about. Because they're horribly primitive, your ideas, and grotesque, you know, in form.
And that's a problem as well, causing people to
someone presents false
ideas.
Right, and someone presents this crude idea of God, and someone else judges the fact of God by that crude idea. Well, you know, part of that is obviously the person that assumes that, you know, this primitive individual defines the nature of God, but, you know, there's, you know, fault to go on both sides. I mean, people should challenge themselves. If they really are interested in telling people about the glory that is God, you need to have something that, you know, is worth talking about to someone who's educated. Right? Some primitive, superstitious thing is not going to impress anyone with any, you know, sophistication of mind. you know, a mild upgrade of the volcano god is not going to do it, right? So
I was even thinking about the anthropomorphic god.
Right, right. You know, the magic man, right? You know, right. I mean, you know, and now unfortunately, you know, starting in the 20th century, because science began to disappear and has now just become a giant superstitious mess again, you know, that's dominated by magic matter, you know, the magic man, you know, if they were you know, sort of equivalent in their consideration of what the religionists are saying, they really shouldn't technically dismiss the stories about the magic man, because the magic man is technically better than the magic matter. At least the magic man has some sort of causality to his, you know, to his the notions of him, right? But magic matter is, you know, acausal, right? It's worse. I mean, the magic man is primitive. Magic matter is pre-primitive, right? You know, and science is now dominated by pre-primitive notions. Anyway, off on a tangent there. It's my soapbox, you know, my soapbox on that one. But nonetheless, yep, you got something on the webinar?
David Jones has a question about the previous paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a sense as to exactly what the finaliters do when they inaugurate their activities?
Well, it's just a matter of, you know, all you kind of really need to, since you can't think about the details at all, it's completely beyond our comprehension. But, you know, even right now, there's finaliters on this world preparing for, you know, or tens of thousands of years in the future, when our world is settled in the first stage of light and life, and they step forward definitively like this. You know, so that's the whole, the main point is they've been in the background for a long, long time. But when the planet starts out in the first stage of light and life, they step out of the shadows, as it were, right, and step forward and, like they're saying, inaugurate their active participation in planetary affairs. Now, you know, obviously that word active needs to be interpreted properly. They've been active before that, you know, but behind the scenes. You know, they mean active, you know, in front of the scenes. Right? That's just a very definitive sign that we're going to start to get really serious now about beginning to get this world to not just be a collection of parts, but begin to be a much more direct representation of the whole, of the Paradise Trinity. Not the Father part, not the Son part, not the Spirit part, or any other part you can think of, but the whole.
Is that the same as we are all one?
Not quite. You got to be careful about oneness. That's a technical complication. The wholeness of the universe of universes is going to start to come out from behind the scenes, just like the finaliters. Right now, there's a wholeness, you know, that we don't appreciate. Like if there wasn't the whole and the individuality of the whole, you couldn't be hearing what I was saying. I'd be an island universe, cut off from everything. Right? The only way there's any interaction between any two parts, right? This distinction is vital. For in a cosmic system, the individual members are not connected to each other except in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole. And that's everything. In fact, I can see that cup on that table. Anything you can think of. In fact, I can see the words on the page of this book. All of that is dependent upon us being linked together. We don't appreciate that. And, you know, they're reminding you that you don't begin to really sort of directly appreciate that until you get into light and life. And the wholeness is starting to be more tangible, like we were just talking about, that you can visualize. Remember, see, why are they telling you about that visualization thing? Because, you know, that fact that there's something literal between all of us that allows us to interact starts to become more tangible. It's like, huh, now either there's magic or there's something in between me and a secondary midwayer that is making it so that we're connected one to the other in a very literal, tangible way now. And it just you know, grows and grows and grows, more and more the wholeness that you're a part in the context of a whole becomes, you know, the first fact. Right? You start to approach everything more top-down, not parts trying to get up to the whole, but a whole, you know, re-engaging the parts anew from the top down. You know, you synchronize with the wholeness and then discover yourself in a transcendent way as a new part. Yeah. Okay, so that's what the whole process is about. And now we're just thinking about, you know, there's beginning to be a wholeness on a planet, and then there's going to be a wholeness to a system, and a wholeness to a constellation, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right? A wholeness that was never there before, okay, in any sort of a recognizable way. It was all behind the scenes.
It's there, we just don't know it.
Right, right. As I was saying, it's just, you know, it's always been there, it always has to be there. It just starts to become something that's more obvious there. You don't have to have just logical recognition to know it's there. Logically, it's got to be there. You know, but now it's more, you know, directly a sense, you know, a sensible, you know, if you will, you know, you can pick it up, you know, through your sensory relationship to the external world.
Visceral home.
Right. Okay. All right. Let's see. I think we got everything there, didn't we? Yeah. Okay. So what else they get? Another little fun tidbit that they haven't given us before here in the next paragraph.
When such an era is attained on your world, no doubt, Machaventa Melchizedek, now the vicegerent planetary prince of Urantia, will occupy the seat of the planetary sovereign. And it has long been conjectured on Gerasim that he will be accompanied by a son and daughter of the Urantia, Adam and Eve, who are now held on Edentia as wards of the Most Highs of Nerlashadek. These children of Adam might so serve on Urantia in association with the Melchizedek sovereign, since they were deprived of procreative powers almost 37,000 years ago at the time they gave up their material bodies on Urantia in preparation for transit to Edentia.
Okay. Again, first things first in the paragraph. All right, so we've got this little reminder, you know, we don't have, yeah, well, you know, we won't at that time have a Lenonidek here anymore. We still have the rebel ones here, right? But you know, eventually they'll be cleared off, and then and Machaventa will actually assume planetary prince, you know, step forward from his vicegerent role and actually take the direct role of planetary prince, and you know, go on to planetary sovereign. And you're going, well, okay, so we won't have a Lenonidek that you could see in the temple. We'll have a Melchizedek. And, you know, well, they are less visible, aren't they? Well, you know, in some sense they're higher, but in another sense they're lower. I mean, right, I mean, if there's a Melchizedek right here, right now, he could make himself visible, right? So, you know, you got to wonder, maybe the Melchizedek might be visible, you know, in a less specialized setting, right, than just in the temple. Who knows? So that's just one little thing between the lines there. Okay, and then I think Don has brought it up a couple times. We've tossed this out several times. About the children, you know, I mean, all of the, you know, basically it's not just the immediate, you know, direct children, but all of the children and children's children, et cetera, of Adam and Eve that were taken off the planet shortly after the default. You know, and were taken to Edentia, like they're reminding you there, to be wards of the Most Highs. Now, you know, some celestials speculate other things, but, you know, I'm reminding you, there is this one speculation afoot that, you know, they'll bring back a pair of those to serve in this role we've been reading about previously of how the Adam and Eve, you know, serve as this linkage between the planetary sovereign and the finaliters. Remember when we read about that and we were speculating, well, who's going to take that role on our planet? You know, there are those who think that the obvious solution to that would be to bring a pair of these from Edentia. Okay, but we've wondered about, well, exactly how does this work? We know they were, you know, dematerialized and transported there and rematerialized. And, you know, remember that they're not, you know, everyone usually remembers that they're not reproducing. Now, like they're reminding us there. But what about a little bit more specific? I mean, exactly are they, I mean, it's like, well, okay, they can't be, they must not have been rematerialized as mortals, because they all would have, you know, long ceased to be a material creature, you know, fused with their adjusters and gone on to ascend or what, you know. Or, I mean, you know, they're obviously talking about bringing back a material pair. All right, so it's like, well, okay, so how is it that they're going on and on materially? I mean, were they rematerialized, you know, instead of that, as they were on our world, mortal, but were they rematerialized where they could use a tree of life fruit and be ongoing? Or were they rematerialized like material sons and daughters are on the system headquarters world, you know, on Gerasim in our case? And they never explain that. You're kind of left to speculate. It's like, well, here you're thinking about it. It's like, I mean, if there is celestials that believe that they could be brought here and really kind of, you know, function in this long term, you know, because, you know, they could be on a world in light and life for a long, 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 long time, and we don't have a tree of life here anymore. I said, well, maybe they could bring a tree of life again. And it's like, well, you know, that you always get the sense that it's like, no, that bridge has, you know, been burned, and it's
literally.
So, all right, so literally, yes. You know, so it's like, maybe the most logical thing is that is when the life carriers rematerialized them, they rematerialized them in that naturally immortal state, like material sons and daughters are on Gerasim. So that, you know, you can just bring them here and they just are naturally ongoing because they have an integrous mind, so they stay plugged in, right? And they don't need a tree of life. Right? So, you know, you're kind of, as you're reflecting, it's like, maybe I'm convincing myself that that's, you know, what's going on. Now, the other little thing they throw in there is interesting. Okay, so, you know, think really closely, zero in, and, you know, and remember other things from the book. As you're reading along, you know, and it says that, the, you know, these children might so serve on Uranus in association with the Melchizedek sovereign. Since they were deprived of procreative powers almost 37,000 years ago, okay, that should stop you if you're, it's like, wait a minute, shouldn't that be, you know, especially, and it says, at the time they gave up their material bodies on Urantia in preparation for transit to Edentia. Okay, you're going, okay, now wait a minute. I mean, you know, Adam and Eve arrived 37,848, if I remember correctly, years ago from 1934. Right, so, you know, and you know it was only, what was it, 117 years until they defaulted? So you're going, wait a minute. Is this a typo? Shouldn't that be almost 38,000 years ago? It's like, okay. So it gets you reflecting. And you're thinking, I could just weasel out of it and say it's a typo, and it's supposed to say 38,000.
Or almost.
You know, almost, because it would be, because technically, it's, you know, if it literally is, you know, it ought to be, you know, almost 38,000, not almost 37. Okay, but you got to remember some other things they've told you about this whole dematerialization, rematerialization process.
Before you do that, maybe it's been changed to 38,000.
No, it hasn't. In Jean's book, no. They all say 37, I'm pretty sure. I don't think anyone has ever, you know, well, I mean, it's actually surprising someone hasn't, okay, messed up this one, too.
It's coming down.
But
don't point it out.
But, you know, I want you to, you know, reflect on this a little bit more deeply, okay? And like I said, think about all they do tell you in various places about this whole dematerialization, rematerialization process. Okay, yes, effectively, they were deprived of procreative powers when they were dematerialized. Okay, you know, they're put in that quasi-Morantia state and transported, right? And, okay, I mean, obviously they're not procreating while they're in transport or anything like that, right? I mean, so effectively, yes, but technically, it's not until they're rematerialized that the life carriers have all the options in play about how to rematerialize them. Like, for instance, our Adam and Eve, right? They dematerialize them on Gerasim, rematerialize them here, and when they rematerialize them, they modify them, right? They're not modified until they're actually rematerialized, or they're modified so that when they procreate, they don't produce innately immortal children, right? They produce their downsteps in their procreative action so that they produce mortal children who get adjusters, etc., right? So, I mean, it's not technically until they're rematerialized that they're technically deprived of their procreative powers. Seemed like we were just speculating. See, when they, all these options of how to rematerialize them, life carriers could optionally rematerialize them different than they were dematerialized here, like making them so that they're innately immortal. Right? Those sorts of things.
What does that have to do with the 37 versus 38?
I'm getting there. I'm just slowly working my... I'm trying to get you to see that there is a complexity here that the relators may not be able to state things very directly, but they can sneak some things in like this, where if you're noticing, you're going, wait a minute, okay, either, you know, there's something, you know, silly going on here, or they're trying to tell me two things at the same time and they really aren't allowed to be overt about it, right? So think about it. I mean, if technically, see, they're deprived of their procreative powers almost 37,000 years ago instead of 38,000 years ago, that means they weren't rematerialized until, you know, something around 1,000 years after they were taken off the planet. Okay. Now, okay, you got something?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, no, it's just a wild guess. Huh? They may have made a request higher up and had to wait for the answer before they knew what they could do.
Right. So that's an option, right? So there's lots of speculations. Let me talk. I mean, obviously, we're just speculating here, but I want you to think about something that would be involved in rematerializing, you know, and hence reconsciousizing. And remember another little tidbit, like, you know, they bring in a material son and daughter to be an Adam and Eve, okay? And for, you know, a span of time while they're being rematerialized, they're still unconscious, okay? You can take them out of the transport seraphim, okay, but they're kept in that unconscious state that they're prepped into before they're put into the transport seraphim. They're kept in that sort of unplugged from mind state, right, until they get fully rematerialized, and then they plug them back into mind, the life carriers. Right. So there's no problem transporting them to Odentia, you know, which is going to take a while, right? Remember, you know, it's, you know, that could be, you know, 200 light years away or something. I mean, it could be quite a ways away to Odentia, you know, but at three times the speed of light, that's not a huge length of time. It's not 1,000 years, right? So this isn't all transport time or something like that. Right, that's too big a number for it just to be a transport issue, okay? Yeah, so they could just be there unconscious, you know, in suspended animation, as, you know, as it were. Remember, they're not in a deep freeze. They're not material. They're this quasi-Morantia energy system.
They have adjusters?
Yeah, I mean, some of them would have had adjusters, others wouldn't, right? There's all those complexities with the adjuster stuff, right? But, you know, but you go, well, what would be, you know, is it something just technical, like they've got to get word down from on high to rematerialize them? Or think about something maybe more, a little more immediate.
It took them off the spaceship, like, and it takes that long to get there.
Well, no, again, you know they were dematerialized, so they used transport seraphim. So it wasn't, you know, they weren't taking a slow boat, you know. Okay, right? But just think about, you know, at the very least, you know, you could certainly have some direct offspring of Adam and Eve, right, that were less than 20 years old. You know, not second generation, first generation offspring of Adam and Eve, that, you know, aren't even 16, they would still be technically mindily connected to their biologic parents.
Oh, they had to wait.
Is it a possibility, see, that they can't rematerialize them until Adam and Eve are back into some mode? It's like, well, so you go, whoa, yeah, that's right. I mean, even though the default was only like 117, I think I'm remembering that correctly, you know, Adam lived 530 years.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay, now that's pushing closer. But that still wouldn't be quite enough to make it almost 37,000 if they were rematerialized, you know, right when Adam and Eve were resurrected. Because remember, there was a special resurrection for them and a few others from the first garden. So it was fairly short order that they were resurrected after they died, you know, relatively short order. But, you know, if we're making these children so that they're kind of like normal Gerasim sort of children, maybe you have to get Adam and Eve up through the mansion worlds and back to Gerasim citizenship, Gerasim citizenship quality of mind, before you can rematerialize the children. And that could vary, even though they said, you know, they go pretty lickety-split through the mansion worlds, obviously. At least the early one, especially, right? But it's like, that seems maybe it's about the right amount. You get them finally to Gerasim citizenship, and that could now be, instead of almost 38,000, that could be almost 37,000, and they would be rematerialized. So, typo is boring. I'm suspicious that that's what they're trying to get you to think through. You know, that there was a delay before they were rematerialized, and it wasn't just because of the transport time. You know, 80 years of transport time or something, right?
That's how the truth of the revelation works.
Right? Yeah, and you know that we're not flying off on a tangent to be thinking like this, because we figured out a long time ago, like you just said, that's the way the revelation is constructed, right? The revelators are always pushing up as close to the boundaries of the mandate as they can and not going over the line, you know? They can't say something directly, but they can suggest it, you know, like crazy.
And you can figure it out.
And you can put the pieces together, right? So, obviously, you know, can't prove any of that, but That would be kind of an interesting way to speculate on the meaning behind that little passage. Yep.
This doesn't solve the problem of our deficit, our material son and daughter deficit. You know, our failure.
It doesn't
get the proper
right. I mean, uplift. It's not the biologic uplift solution. No. Right. I mean, like we said, you know, they're bringing them here in light and life, and you basically have taken care of all the fact that we didn't get the full biologic uplift by selective breeding and genetic engineering. Right. You know, you've made up for that by the time they would be brought in play. You know, and then remember how we reread that there's still a little bit of selective breeding, you know, that goes on. To not for immediate biologic reasons, but for all of the higher reasons, intellectual, you know, philosophical, whatnot, on up. So you know, you just need you need some kind of beings that can serve in this intermediary role between the sovereign, planetary sovereign, and the finaliters. We don't know what the deal is with that. They just tell us that there is some sort of intermediate role. And to be this very visible, tangible, easily tangible, representation of the planetary administration. Right? To serve as really kind of the voice, like the reflective image aids, or the avatar and voice for the intangible beings in the, at the higher levels. Okay, so I was just going to look here. Let's see. Let me just make sure. I've said it so many times, I should check to make sure. Yes, 117 years until the default. Yeah, so. All right. So there's the little fun tidbit. And like I said, it's amazing that someone hasn't thought, oh, there's a typo, let's change that. Anyway. Okay, could we get everything else in there? Let's see, we've got, talked about the Melchizedek. I was going to just mention, remember the other beings that are being dematerialized and rematerialized, they'll show up in the story here in a while, are the Midsoniters. Just to think about that when they talk about that. I mean, yeah, effectively, they don't have procreative powers once they're dematerialized, but, technically, right, it's not until they're rematerialized that the life carriers are putting him in that non-reproducing expression, body. And exactly technically what that, means, I'm not sure.
At the time they gave up their material.
Right, see, and that's what I was trying to point out. See, effectively, yes. Right, but there's just this technically thing. They're not this material being again, right, that's non-reproducing until they're rematerialized. Right? Obviously, they're not reproducing when they're when they're not a material being. They're just this Marantia energy, like Marantia-like energy expression of their nature, although they're being transported. Another thing that's in that same spirit, we mentioned just a minute ago, there's always this issue of transport time. And a lot of times the revelators don't explicitly, point to that. And they'll say, resurrected on the third day. Well, except for they remind you, technically remember it's the third period because, that middle quote-unquote day, there's transport. If you don't have to be transported, it's just a day. But if you've got to be transported, that could be a long stretch of time, years and years and years to be transported. You always have to remind yourself of that, that there may be a technical issue that they're not belaboring the sentence with, right? And it's up to you to, to not interpret the sentence simplistically and remind yourself of that technicality if that's important, right? If you want to go beyond the truth of it to the fact of it, okay, you got to remember the technical details, right? And that's all, and again, so you can do that without going off the rails if you're approaching things from the top down, truth first, fact second. Don't start out in the facts with some false, preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices and go off the rails. Right? Because what we just said sounds like, from a subjective perspective, sounds like a very horrendous, convoluted rationalization scheme. Okay? How can you tell the difference between a mere rationalization scheme and a valid interpretation? Subjectively, they're indistinguishable, right? But objectively, they have a different feel, right? You have a reality response with one and not the other. The other one just sits there flat dead relative to a reality response. It's like, that's just a yada, yada, yada. That's just a rationalization scheme, right?
So The typo feels right to me.
The typo is a lot easier, I think. And for those timid souls that like to take the path of least resistance, that's what I say, it's surprising if someone hasn't changed it. Okay. They got one other little tidbit here, you know, a little footnote. They've got a large paragraph break. They give us another little tidbit here. What do they say? Oh, is there a question? Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Winston wonders, can spirit substance be dematerialized and rematerialized, or just beings?
It wouldn't be technically dematerialized. It'd be despiritized and respiritized. Again, there's no point to that. Right? I mean, obviously you could imagine it. But the only reason things are dematerialized and rematerialized is so you can transport them. Right? There's no issue transporting spirit substance. Right? Or Marantia substance. You don't have to demaranchicize and remaranchicize it either, right? Because it's transportable. It's just a technicality. You can't transport combustible matter, as it were, right? You've got material substance is fully grounded in the three dimensions of the finite. Right? So it's fundamentally can't be moved even at the speed of light, let alone three times the speed of light. Right? It's got to be a substance that is less embedded in the finite, so that transfinite transporting, remember again, three times the speed of light is not a literal finite speed. That's impossible. There is no such thing. That's an effective speed. They're delocalizing and relocalizing effectively at that speed, relative to the distance between point A and point B. And they're not literally going down embedded in the finite at that speed. You can do that. If you try to take something up to the speed of light as a purely finite phenomenon, it'll go back to the force charge of space. Right? I mean, that's how the finite stuff started, at the speed of light, the force charge of space, and you've slowed it down. Right? You'll de-individuate it. I mean, that's why, and you can't de-individuate it, that's why you can't take anything up to the speed of light. You'd have to de-individuate the ultimatons, and you can't de-individuate ultimatons with a finite process. Right? Yeah. Again, bringing in some philosophy to the science so that it isn't magic, right? Like current science is.
Chris, when they talk about, just on that same point, the projectile, when they take off and they're visible to what they say, they actually describe how long they're visible.
Right, right.
Until they're outside of, even their...
Even seraphic vision and things like that,
It makes you sound like, it sounds like it's an actual projectile that you can actually visualize. Right. Which at that stage maybe
and the reason that there's something to visualize is, remember, it's to get to three times the speed of light, that's a sum of three. You have two exact speed of light speeds plus something that's a little less than the speed of light. It's not literally three times the speed of light. It's a little less than three.
Right.
It's exactly one plus not quite one, right? Because there's one dimension that is still embedded down in the finite and hence can't get up to the speed of light, right? And that one dimension, means that there's going to be a visible phenomenon, right? If it was fully transcendent, then nothing would be visible, and it would it would just disappear and go instantaneously to wherever, right? Or close to it. Okay.
But two aspects that are traveling at the speed.
It's really a three. It's really three dimensions of the absonite.
Okay.
Okay. But one of those dimensions of the absonite is projected down into the finite, and the other two aren't. And that's why, you can't imagine somehow getting X, Y, and Z in the finite all in one direction. Okay. But. A dimension of an absonite dimension projects into all dimensions in the finite. The absonite z-axis projects down into every direction in the finite, not just one direction. Right? So, you can have those three lined up relative to a finite process. That's anyway, and if you look at when they describe that differential between the three. Two of them are energy and the other is power. They describe it as power because, like I said, it's embedded down in the finite. Okay, and it's subject to the speed limit, right? Not being, you know, not being de-individuatable.
What is the speed limit? Is it 97%?
And remember, there's the issue with the, you know, the density of material along the path of, you know, that they're moving. You know, the freer the space, the higher the effective speed. And even solitary messengers, you know, which are very transcendent, still are subject to that some degree, right? Because they're not, you know, not traveling effectively at infinite speed. Okay. So they have some measure of projection down into the finite, even if it's kind of just a little, you know, fingernail tip, you know, quote unquote, right? There is going to be a column density along their effective path. The more material density, the more effective space you have to go through. Because remember, space is part of matter. Space is a reality. It's not just, you know, the concept of potential separation. It's a literal fact, right? You know, and so you've got the space in between the stuff, you know, which we recognize, but there's also the space within the stuff. They've got to, you know, yeah, navigate through that too, right? You know, and the denser the material, the more space there is there, the longer the effective path, right? And hence the slower the effective speed.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so if the solitary messenger, you know, passes through several stars, especially dense ones, on the way to point B, right, his speed is going to be a little bit slower. You know, but, you know, 4.5 million times the speed of light is still pretty darn fast. Right? But he's technically slowed down a little bit. Okay. And it's the same way with all these other beings, divine counselors, you know, or transport angels or whatever. They're all going to have some, you know, and that's why when they talk about that third dimension, they say, well, you know, it's usually kind of in this ballpark, you know, but, you know, it varies on the path they're traveling.
Does it vary, yeah, depending on what is being transported?
We don't know all the physics of it, maybe. I don't know.
This, yeah, guy's so dense.
You know, I don't. Right? If they transported me, you know, it'd take forever to go from point A to point B because of my density, yes. I mean, I don't know. I mean, again, all this physics, I mean, who knows? Yeah. It's obviously possible, but maybe remember, there's great mysteries to the transport seraphim in the first place. I mean, the secrets of them are, you know, most beings in the universe don't even know the secrets of them. They're secrets of one of the Father's worlds, right? Who knows who really understands all of that physics? You know, they may understand it empirically, but, you know, internally, literally, I mean, maybe not so much, I don't know. Okay, all right, now let's try that final little statement there.
This settled age continues on and on until every inhabited planet in the system attains the era of stabilization. And then, when the youngest world, the last to achieve light and life, has experienced such settledness for 1 millennium of system time, the entire system enters the stabilized status, and the individual worlds are ushered into the system epoch of the era of light and life.
Okay, so you see why there's the big paragraph break. Because up to that point, we're kind of just repeating the stuff we've been talked about before, adding a few other little tidbits, but it's kind of just a summary. This is the real meat of what we're talking about, is thinking about transitioning into this local system, settled in light and life. Yeah. Okay, so, you know, let's think about our local system. You know, like that millennium of system time, then, that 1,000 years of system time. You know, for our local system, remember Gerasim time, that would be about 809 years then, you know, Urantia time. You might read, it depends on how many decimal places, you know, I mean, roughly it's, you remember, it's 80% or 81%. It's technically 80.9%. Okay, so, right, so, You know, it's about 1,000 years still. Okay, but think about all that's leading up to that. I mean, that's a trivial amount of time compared to what leads up to it. All right, so like take our local system. You know, remember we, you know, when we're talking about inhabited planets in general, they gave us these tidbits about our local system. You know, we roughly have had three blocks of 200 worlds in our local system. You know, we're towards the end of the third block, 606, right? And they tell you the next block is getting close to life implantation. Well, again, time scales vary, but let's just, you know, let's just do base it all on our bias. You know, so let's say, you know, it takes 500 million years, roughly, to get that next block of 200 up to light and life. You know, on these time scales, we're effectively in light and life right now, right? I mean, the difference is irrelevant at this scale. You know, and then you'd have another block. I mean, you know, it may be a billion years or so from now before you would have this whole local system settled in light and life.
I can see all the other planets waiting. Come on.
Right, so think about how deep in light and life this world is going to be a billion years from now. Right, we are going to be way down that road, okay? I mean, you can imagine maybe that we're fully into seventh stage light and life before our local system gets settled.
Fraternizing with finality.
Right, I mean, you'll have those absentite beings and all that sort of stuff going on this planet, right? Like we were reading about. I mean, okay, so, you know, that's the kind of time scales we're dealing with. Just to get the local, our local system, you know, and who knows, you know, it might be longer, you know, but just, you know, back of the envelope, let's, you know, a billion years, say, okay? All right. So, you know, start to, you know, and so again, why are we reading about all this stuff? Who cares? Again, like we mentioned, if nothing else, bring in that more eternalized frame of reference. Stop doing like even Adam and Eve did. And it's like, well, if it doesn't happen in 100 years, who cares? Right? How long did they last? 117 years. Right? They were impatient after 117 years. Humans have the same, you know, temporal reference frame, right? Start thinking in bigger terms, right? Thinking, well, you know, if we just all squint right, we could have light and life in my lifetime. No, okay? you know, that's way, way down the road. And the really cool stuff is even further down the road. And stop, you know, trying to live your life in that ridiculous false temporal context. Like they said, remember, stop trying to cram an eternity into a few short years on this planet. Right? Think bigger. Get a bigger picture. You know, start to approach your life from the top down. You know, instead of this ridiculous, false, bottom-up exaltation, you know, that everyone is doing. You know, get some humility, you know, into your worldview. You know, and you know, if it happens in a billion years, that's fast.
Yeah.
Relative to the big things. Right? I mean, Michael's seven bestowals were spread out over a billion years. Right? You know, was he peeing his pants every other day? You know, are we there yet? Are we there yet? No. Right? Just settle in, right, to the big picture.
But meanwhile, back at farm, a billion years from now, we should be
right. Yeah, I mean, and how far will we be, you know, away from this world a billion years from now,
yeah.
Right? You know, that ought to get you to Havona, probably, anyway, you know?
Yeah.
now, how long it's going to take us to go through Havona, you know, right? But it's a billion worlds. That's a lot of experiencing. But right. See, we're way down the road, and the planet is going to be way down the road. And so we're really getting way removed from anything that's even remotely, us as individuals here. So can you think this abstractly to continue on to the next section even, right? I mean, even before we get to the second stage, right, we're talking something that's so ridiculously beyond our imagination. You know, we were saying you couldn't even remotely imagine just the individual world issues, you know, of a world enlightened life. Well, now what in the heck is coming into play when the whole system is enlightened life and somehow upstepping what's going on in the world? See, this is just so abstractly beyond. Okay. But nonetheless, just knowing that there's no end to the inscrutable transcendence of what lies ahead, right? And you can go on and on and on, you know, inscrutable to the, you know, seventh power, the hundredth power, the thousandth power, and you still haven't gotten to the grand universe settled in light life. Then there's all the absentite ages, right? So just all of this, if you get nothing else from the book, if humans just had this bigger perspective, and they wouldn't be marching around with signs. What do we want? Fill in your favorite material idealistic thing. You know, when do we want it? Now. We would stop that foolishness, right? We would settle in, right? Be the tadpole that we're supposed to be. Instead of thinking, you know, like Kalagasha taught us to think, you know, jumping way ahead. It's like, no, you're a transcendent frog. No, I'm a little ignorant tadpole, right? Right? You know, we get way ahead. That's why this book is in my lap, remember, because we're all getting ahead of ourselves. It's not that we have false ideals. It's just that we're trying to apply these ideals now instead of them being something we set our sights towards in the future. You apply them now, you collapse civilization. You apply them then, it's light and life. But you apply them now, and it's the orgy of darkness and death. Same thing, just misapplied. Misapplied, wrongly applied. Right? Produces an emergency, and a whole super universe mobilizes to get a book in my lap. Say, someone's got to wake up here. You're about to blow yourself up, you know. Maybe literally, you know, but at least figuratively, you know, you're about to collapse civilization. I mean, nuclear weapons are the least of our worries. I mean, civilization collapsing is much worse than nuclear war. Okay? All right, that's a lot, you know, don't worry about nuclear war or chemical catastrophes or something. Worry about civilization collapsing and having to start all over again with fear and hunger, right, in the nutrition epoch and having to work our way to the security age and then begin, you know, the material comfort era all over again. Right? That's what you should be worried about. That's a real problem.
And that's what they worried about, why this is here. And,
this isn't here because of the possibility of pollution. Right? This is here because of something real. We can mow through pollution, right? But we can't mow through embracing the rebellion and collapsing civilization. And
starting from scratch.
Right. Right. There'll be a long, long interregnum of darkness on this world. Right? Okay, you don't want to condemn your grandchildren to that future. So we need to wake up. It won't happen in your lifetime, but worry about someone besides yourself. Right? That's what a civilized human does.
And we've already had long, long periods of darkness.
Right. Right. The last one was 900 years. The next one will be even longer. Because the bigger they are, the harder they fall.
Think how long it was after the rebellion.
Right, right, yeah, not to mention how long it was right after the rebellion 200,000 years ago. Right? But even the Middle Ages was 900 years. Right? Right, and that was just falling off of that tiny little ledge that you had, you know, 2,000 years ago. Think about how high we are now, how hard we'll hit when we fall. Okay.
It's going to leave a mark.
All right. So, but let's put that behind. We're imagining transcendent glory of things getting settled in light and life. So what happens if you move on from that incredible, unimaginable starting point of the system settling in light and life?
Section 8, the second or system stage. When an entire system becomes settled in life, a new order of government is inaugurated. The planetary sovereigns become members of the system conclave. And this new administrative body, subject to the veto of the Constellation Fathers, is supreme in authority. Such a system of inhabited worlds becomes virtually self-governing. The system legislative assembly is constituted on the headquarters world, and each planet sends its 10 representatives thereto. Courts are now established on the system capitals, and only appeals are taken to the universe headquarters.
Okay, so a couple things there that you maybe are already noticing. It's like, I'm getting the idea here. Okay, so the first, though, is just that, you know, like we said, they haven't been talking about the bigger picture as we were going through the planetary stages of light and life. Like the planetary sovereigns, not just being all about the planet, but starting to take on this bigger role, you know, and assembling in these conclaves, you know, at the local system headquarters and starting to be part of a local system government, not just a planetary government.
All 1,000.
Right, all roughly 1,000 of them, yeah. Right. Okay. And then the second part of that, you know, should, oh, I see what Lucifer was, you know, remember how, you know, remember he was doing something that was, you know, existentially proper, but he was doing it, wanting to do it too soon. Right? What was one of the very first things he did when he did, you know, initiated the rebellion? He established legislative and judicial functions on, instead of just executive, on the local system headquarters. It's like, that's not inherently wrong, right? Existentially wrong, but if you bring in time, it's nothing but wrong. It's rebellion, right? Because you're not, that doesn't happen until the local system is settled in light and life.
Yeah.
He was jumping all the way ahead to that point.
Short-circuiting the evolution.
He's doing just the same thing that everyone that's unwittingly joining the rebellion on this planet is doing, and you can only do that if you have spiritual consciousness that can visualize an ideal off in the remote distance and ignorantly think you should apply it now. Right? He knew exactly, you know, all the details of how things get set up way when the system is settled. Right? So he just implemented that 200,000 years ago, right? Instead of like a billion years from now.
How big of a short circuit was it?
Right? Short circuiting a billion years of evolution, you know, an incredibly complex, you know, roughly 1,000 world system of interactions and super additive consequences.
That's funny because the truth of that is very interesting. I'm on a board of a company that has hired a guy who was running a billion-dollar company, but it's a new company.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's doing exactly the same thing. He is projecting it as a, running it like a billion-dollar company versus a new company.
Yeah.
You know, and I keep having to tell him, no, we're a startup, you know. Right. Yeah, that's fine for later on, but not for now.
Right.
That kind of thing. And it's kind of interesting how that truth follows through in a number of things.
I see. And the more spiritual we get, the more we do that. And even the seemingly most non-spiritual things, like a business starting up, you're injecting, you know, this idealism. It's supposed to be spiritual idealism, but you don't see any spirit substance. You don't stub your toe on spirit substance. So you try to apply it to material affairs, this idealism. And all material idealism is false, fundamentally, because what we're just talking about. Because you're applying something that is about the future to the present. You're short-circuiting. You're thinking that that there is no whole with its time scale that evolves, and that you need to be humbly subservient to that whole and its time scale. You're just a part. Right? It knows how long things should take, not you. Right? You know, it starts out with things that some little more wise individuals can recognize, like, no, that should take 5 years of business development, not 2 months, right? Because you've got the wisdom, you've got the experience to see that big of a picture. But someone who burrows down, right, doesn't see that big picture.
Yeah,
And that's just a whole hierarchy of, you know, you can always have too small a picture in your mind because you're not philosophic enough. Right? If you're just scientific or religious, you know, and the technical details of a business are technically a science, right? And there's a whole knowledge of the details of how, you know, that's a science technically. Right? But where's the philosophy? Where's the top-down, big-picture objectivity, the wisdom, right, and the awareness of truth that keep things in their time and place and stable. Keep things coordinated, properly organized, right?
My dad had a little phrase he used to tell me. He used to say, inch by inch, life's a cinch, yard by yard, you'll find it hard.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is... Right. Same principle.
Recognizing that it's an evolutionary process and you need to be humbly subservient to it. Don't think that you are the dictator of the speed. It's like, well, if I walk faster, the whole universe will go faster. No, it won't. You'll just disconnect from it.
Come on, get out of my way.
Right? And when you disconnect from that, you're no longer upheld. And you fall. Right? You disconnect the civilization from its upholding and it collapses. You're trying to make it go too fast, which means it goes off of the upholding hand and falls. Right? We can do that. We have free will. We can move it off the upholding hand if we choose, but it wouldn't be wise because it's not magical. It'll fall if it's not upheld. Right? We start to believe that things are self-maintaining, you know, and then we can just dictate the speed of them. No.
So, Chris, yep. What are these 10 representatives
mm-hmm.
that they sent?
Yep, yep.
Are they humans?
I don't know.
Because how do they send them there?
right, I mean, so, you know, that was the first thought you have. It's like, well, okay, well, I guess they could. They could dematerialize them and rematerialize them, I guess. You know, but, well, maybe that means they're not humans, you know. I don't know. I mean, remember, when the place is settled in light and life, there's all these beings on here that they can't even reveal to us. I don't know, right? You can only speculate. Yeah. But if you speculate, you got to do it logically, not magically, right? You got to think about things like if it's going to be a human, they've got to be dematerialized and rematerialized.
Warp speeds.
No one can. Yeah, there aren't super luminal spaceships or anything like that, right? Right. There's no Enterprises, you know, or Millennium Falcons or whatever, right? Yeah. Okay. So this is, you know. It took us this long. We had to get this far down the road before we could finally see literally how Lucifer was jumping the gun. He was jumping all the way to this point.
That's hugely insane.
It's just self-righteous. It's like, you know, again, you know, you're it's like, no, that whole thing's evolving. That's just, you know, the notions of oppressors. You know, we have free will, you know, self-assertion was a battle cry, you know, not subservience to the whole, right? It was self-assertion, right? If we wanted to go fast, you know, remember the life carriers tell you they could do that. They could get you, you know, it wouldn't have to take 500 million years to evolve things, you know, evolve humans. They could get it done in, you know, just a few million years. But that would be self-righteousness, right? The time scale of the evolution has to match, synchronize with the evolution of the whole. Anything faster is rebellious. They have to remember that's why they have decimal worlds. You know, roughly every 10th world, they do a test to try to make sure they know exactly how the Supreme is going, so they can properly synchronize with the Supreme. Because if they do it too fast or too slow, it's false evolution. It's got to be true evolution. It's got to be precisely synchronized with where the Supreme is at this time and place. Right? And they have to test that. They don't just know that. They don't look it up in a book, some divine text. You know, they've got to actually do an experiment and, you know, record some data and figure, you know, empirically figure out where the Supreme is right now.
In the trenches.
Right? That's we're a test world, you know.
Somehow morality is tied to this.
Yeah.
Right now we have the harebrained idea that morality is determined by who we elect.
or what we dictate or whatever. Right?
Morality is the background against how we need to elect people.
Right.
Not the way we determine what's moral.
Right. Yeah, and yeah, remember that, you know, humans have never known what the word moral means. It's only with the revelation you finally can figure out what that word means. You know, we've only been trying to figure it out for, you know, about 2,000 years. It was Cicero that coined it. Okay. Everyone has always used the word moral as just conformity to the mores system. But that's not what it is. That's conformity to the mores system, right? Morals has nothing to do with that bottom-up mores system point of view, right? Your moral duty is your duty to the cosmos. It's speaking about your conformity to the whole, right? And me purely as an individual can strike step with the whole, put myself in a moral frame of mind, synchronized with the universal harmony. And then I can take that inner conformity to the cosmos, and I can manifest it outward into relationship to others who have done that also, moral beings, and we can establish a true ethics, you know, our duty to others, you know. But a true duty to others and ethics is predicated on true morality, a conformity to the cosmos, a duty to the cosmos. You have a duty to the cosmos first, because only then, when you have a duty to others second, will that relationship be true. Otherwise, it's going to be some sort of preconceived opinion, whatnot, you know, that's dictating this, and it's going to have issues. Yeah. So, yes, you see, it's just more you think about it, all this stuff, we're trying to get this top-down, this philosophic starting point before we get down into the trenches with science and religion. All right, let's see, we just did that first paragraph, didn't we? Yeah, okay, so move on here. Yep.
With the settling of the system, the assigned sentinel, representative of the super-universe supreme executive, becomes the volunteer advisor to the system's supreme court and actual presiding officer of the new legislative assembly.
And remember, they've mentioned this, the assigned sentinel, a few times. And, you know, again, you've got the Ancients of Days and the Supreme Executives, you know, two different expressions, both beginning to get more and more involved in the details of what's going on, because that Trinity government, you know, is beginning to get into the details, right? It's not just a big overarching, you know, ceiling on the whole phenomenon and, you know, a slight gentle over control. It's now really getting into control down in the trenches. These various complexities of the Trinity government. Supreme executives are trinitized into existence just like Ancients of Days. A little bit different way that they're trinitized into existence, but nonetheless they're both trinitized into existence. You know, and Ancients of Days is a direct offspring of the Paradise Trinity. But, you know, you've got this whole trinitized phenomenon beginning to get into the details. You know, and the finaliters are arranging things so that these higher trinitized expressions can plug in. Right? They're preparing the soil, right, for all of this increasing Trinity expression. All right. They're going to say a few details like this that I can't say anything profound at this point. Why exactly, you know, is it important for them to be an advisor to the system, Supreme Court, and stuff like that? I mean, maybe eventually you could get enough of a science of all this stuff, you know, developed by following the truths of the revelation that you could say something precise about that, but, you know, I can't say anything right now. But they're obviously giving you these details because eventually you could figure this stuff out. Like, oh yeah, that's how that fits in like that, and you know, so a few hundred years from now, humans, you know, might be able to figure some of these details out like that.
This thing's effectively a Trinity origin construct.
Yeah, so you'd have to get into some really, you know, complex transcendent recognition of administrative proper coordination, right? To figure this stuff out. But it's there, you know, you can't help but notice that they gave you that detail for some unknown reason. Okay.
After the settling of an entire system in light and life, the system sovereigns will no more come and go. Such a sovereign remains perpetually at the head of his system. The assistant sovereigns continue to change as in former ages.
Does that another light bulb go off about Lucifer with that one? Do you remember? I mean, remember how way back when we read about the Lindonodex, you know, initially when they introduced him, you know, they talked about him being system sovereigns and assistant, you know, assistants and stuff. Remember how they said that they rotate on a pretty short-term basis normally. Yeah, but then when you finally get to the Lucifer Rebellion, they tell you, well, now Lucifer and Satan, however, you know, had been reinstated in those roles over and over and over again, many, many, you know, normal cycles. Oh, so that just kind of feeds into his delusion. It's like, because he knows eventually when the local system is settled in light and life, he is just, you know, the ongoing system sovereign, and he doesn't get cycled out. It's like, well, I'm already effectively there. They seem to be almost suggesting that I should do this. The fact that they're making me the ongoing system sovereign. See, it feeds into his delusion.
Shouldn't they have cycled him out on the first, really? You right. Go to short circuit at the short circuit.
Again, you know, the correct choice needs to be just that. A choice, not imposed upon us. You know, we have to recognize what we should do in general. We're not told what we should do. It's a free will system.
Hindsight's 20/20.
You have the free will to misinterpret the affairs of your life. Well, the way it's been going, I'm pretty sure this means, you know, humans do this all the time, and you try to act upon the supposed truth of what you just recognized about your life. Well, you quickly discover it isn't truth that you're obeying. It's error because it all falls apart in short order. Right? Right? He thought he had the truth of it. I'm in truth. I'm already the permanent, you know, system sovereign here. No. Error. See, all these things you can learn, again, there's nothing they say about Lucifer that's said just for the sake of history. It's all to teach you something about your own self. You know, you can repeat everything that he did, you know, in truth. I mean, you can't repeat, you know, the things. In fact, obviously, you're not a system sovereign. But the truth of everything he did, you can repeat. Or the error.
Yeah.
Right?
The mind physics apply.
Right. And it's all there to be learned from. You can be just as impatient. You can be just as far-seeing in your ideals. You can just as inappropriately apply the future to the present.
Well, you can be far-seeing, but it doesn't mean you have to drop wisdom at the same time.
And the whole thing is just recognize that when you're far-seeing, you're looking towards an ideal, not an idea.
Yeah.
Like, don't, and you got to translate that into an idea.
Like one day standing in front of, Father is, far seeing, but you're right. I mean, that one day is.
They've been doing this all the time in these papers on the light and life. You know, they gave us those examples of what's going on in a world in light, first stage of light and life, and going, does that remind you of some things you're doing right now? Now think about it. Are you in light and life? No, you're in the material comfort era, and you're doing things that are not appropriate until the age of light and life. That's going to be a problem. Right? It's just as simple as that. It's not that you're somehow, you know, way off in evil land. It's like you just are forgetting about time. Your spiritual consciousness has no notion of time. Your material consciousness needs to remind your spiritual consciousness that the two have to work together and inform each other. Your spiritual consciousness inspires your material consciousness, and your material consciousness grounds your spiritual consciousness. Right? We have ungrounded spiritual consciousness. Right? In general, the spiritual consciousness is good, but we're just applying it without any pragmatic recognition of where and when we are. Right? We're not even in the quest for knowledge and wisdom yet. We're still in the material comfort era. You got to translate an idea way down. You can't apply it even remotely directly.
And it has to do with the sovereignty of will. Because if you try to do something premature, you're not allowing people the opportunity to choose. You're trying to force it
and learn thereof.
And you can't force free will. Yeah, I mean, these higher ages, everybody's already up to this place to where they are choosing. But they're choosing the next step. They're not choosing the next 1,000 steps.
Right. You just brought up morality a second ago. Morality is an inner life issue. It's an exercise of free will to conform your mind to the cosmos. Right? So can you legislate morality? No. You can legislate mores systems, right? I mean, that's what legislation is basically, you know, just a codification of the mores system, right? Laws. We blur these things together. And so, you know, and the more spiritual we get, the more we blur the spiritual and the material together. And the more we need to get up above material and spiritual and keep them objectively separated. We're just blurring everything together, right? Religion is all balled up inside of economics and politics and sociology. No, all right. No, religion is about spirit substance. Politics, economics, social, issues, those are about engaging material affairs, not spirit substance. Religion is about ideals, not about ideas. Right? Is there any genuine religious individuals, phenomenon? Basically none. I mean, what religionist thinks that they're trying to synchronize with spirit substance? No, they think they're trying to find the sacred arrangement of molecules. Right? If I arrange carbon atoms like this, it's sacred. No, it has nothing to do with molecules. Religion has to do with spirit substance. Right? Not with all kinds of fancy material things, and supposed idealistic arrangements of material things. Ideals are about spirit, not matter.
They have a name for this called the social creed.
Mm-hmm. It's just, you could just go on and on. The more you recognize this, the more you say, wow, we have this sweeping philosophic problem. No one is above any of this and properly keeping this stuff separated. So material gravity just balls it all together into confusion. Right? And the key thing, you can't initiate anything unless religion stands apart. The more religion becomes a material thing, and hence material gravity draws it in with everything else, the more you short-circuit it. You can't, philosophy is a super additive consequence. If you decrease the distance between the two of them to zero, you short circuit it. There is no super additive consequence. Philosophy disappears. Yeah. So philosophy either disappears because there's inadequate science or there's inadequate religion in any true sense for either. And it's short circuited one way or the other or both. Right? And once you short-circuit it and philosophy basically goes away, like it has for almost 100 years now, you lose the truth of both of them. Right? There's no truth to science anymore. It's just a magical rationalization scheme now. Right? because the only thing that maintains them true is that philosophic oversight. Science is rational, but it's not logical, so it's not actually science. You can build devices with rationalization schemes, but you can't know the true nature of reality, physical reality. Okay, meanwhile, back to here. All right, so this whole issue of, that's fundamentally all the details of what Lucifer did. You finally understand. You got the basic confusion, but the specific things that he implemented, it's all this, see? He's in the mode where he's functioning as if the local system was settled in light and life, right? And you notice how, remember how he talks about the confederation of worlds and all that stuff? Everything is all in the same plane, right? It's not a federated relationship anymore. It's a confederated relationship, just like they're talking about here. See, everything, the system, the planetary princes or planetary sovereigns are now right all in the same plane, with the local system headquarters. You see, that's the whole mode he was in, collapsing that hierarchy. It's like, well, eventually it will effectively collapse. The bottom will evolve up to that level and everything will be on that level. But it has to evolve up to that level. You can't just fiat it up to that level. And that's what he was trying to do. Okay, so you should, really kind of get the more of the sense of exactly what he was up to there. See?
It's going up to that level. And what he did is tried to bring everything down.
Yeah, right, effectively what happened, right. He just collapsed everything, yeah. All right.
During this epoch of stabilization, for the first time, Midsoniders come from the universe headquarters worlds of their sojourn to act as counselors to the legislative assemblies and advisors to the adjudicational tribunals. These Midsoniders also carry on certain efforts to inculcate new moda meanings of supreme value into the teaching enterprises which they sponsor jointly with the finaliters. What the material suns did for the mortal races biologically, the Midsonite creatures now do for these unified and glorified humans in the ever-advancing realms of philosophy and spiritualized thinking.
Okay, so remember we talked about that basically happening as you're going through the more settled stages on the world. Oh, so technically that's how that's happening, is the Midsonites are coming into play and helping with that transbiologic stuff, right? The fullness of ever higher, without end, philosophic minds. Right? Because the science and religion are confined to the plane, but philosophy is super additive, and there's no ceiling to that super additivity. You have to get higher and higher beings involved to keep catalyzing it upward. And so that's the Midsonators. And it's like, so they're kind of, like mortals, so they can interface, in a way like the material sons and daughters. Okay, I understand that part, but they are kind of transcendent of basic material creatures, so that makes sense. But more specifically, why are they so appropriate here? The Midsoniters become the wards of whom when they leave their home worlds?
Created by Melchizedek, right?
The Finaliters. They become the wards of the Finaliters. They're the assistants to the Finaliters and that whole Trinity mission that the Finaliters are on. Yeah.
Stay in the universe that they're in.
And they stayed in the they remember they're headquartered at the local universe headquarters with the Finaliters. Eventually, but they're rooted in each. Each local system has its Finaliter world, so they have that specificity of a given local system. You think, you suppose it's the the Midsoniters from that local system that are coming to the back to that local system to help? I mean, that would be your first guess. You're not certain, but maybe. But the key thing is that they are, you know, they've gotten themselves into the whole scheme with the Finaliters, and their very transcendent ministry towards, you know, establishing the conduits for everything to flow to the grand universe settled in light and life as this ever more trinitized phenomenon. Right, so that's why they're involved, you know, most specifically.
And Midsoniters again, I'm sorry.
Okay, so remember, there's Midsonite world, one Midsonite world in each local system. Those beings are procreated by a material daughter and a Melchizedek that manifests himself materially. And literally does the biologic, you know, thing with those material daughters and procreates offspring. Okay. Remember we talked about that back in the Life Carrier one. Sure. Just to remind you of how, you know, when we're talking about a Melchizedek, you know, morphing themselves into a material expression, I mean, this isn't some sort of like, well, it looks like they have the same outline as us, but if I, you know, go inside, you know, they don't have lungs and heart and, no. I mean, they've got all the plumbing right down to the details. They've got everything exactly like you, right? And which means they always do. I remember talking about that. I mean, they may be a quote-unquote spirit being, but you can just morph that into something that's got all of the veins and, you know, and nerves and, right, everything just like us. Right, so, you know, there's, you know, genetics is a hierarchical phenomenon. You know, a Melchizedek has an internal genetics, and that's obvious when they morph themselves into a material being, and ta-da, there's chromosomes. Right, right. The chromosomes were already there; they didn't magically come out of nowhere.
They're not utilizing the adjutants or anything like that. Third cosmic mind.
Those issues. We're not so certain about exactly how the whole minded thing works and stuff, but you know, remember secondary midwayers. They're enough like us that the sixth and seventh adjutants can engage them, but Marantia mind can also engage them. Yeah, and they're down at a pretty low level, so you know that kind of, you know, plus the unrevealed order of angels, right? The lesser order of angels. Right, I mean, they're also pretty close to us. They're like a secondary midwayer, only, you know, an angel-like being. Yeah, so that tells you that non-adjutant mind does come way down to the trenches here. You know, so maybe that's how it works with the Melchizedek. Right, they can just access, you know, it's not Marantia mind or adjutant mind, but the kind of mind that like Seraphim and other beings use in the local universe. And apparently that maybe, you know, maybe that's what they use, and it just at that way down at those lower levels of it.
Yeah, the width and depth of the adjutants, I'm
trying to so yeah, so not only do the adjutants go way up, like you normally don't think of them, but the you know, the non adjutant mind comes way down like you normally don't think of it too, see. Yeah. Because they're literally just kind of parallel expressions, one descending and one ascending, you know, sort of in nature. Okay. All right, let's see, so where were we? We got the Midsoniters. Okay, so and they're helping out with these new legislative assemblies and tribunals, obviously, again, helping them to be properly objective, right? Because that's the problem. You know, if you bring these things from on high down low, they could lose their objectivity, you know, unless more objective beings were intimately involved, right? So that's why they're needing to help out, make sure that everyone down the local system is still keeping the local universe sort of big picture in mind as they're adjudicating, right? Not getting all parochial about it, right? Right, so they got that, and you know, again, you know that whole bit we were pondering about how far you can go up with adjutant mind. See, they're helping you to go higher up into adjutant mind, you know, so that you can bring new moda meanings and all that stuff that normally you can't do without Marantia mind, right? So you're standing on the shoulders of giants. You're leveraging off of them to get up higher. Yeah, and we see again the realms of philosophy and spiritualized thinking. And remember, by spiritualized, you mean like Holy Spirit, right? Not merely spiritual, but holy spiritual. You know, the full triune spiritualized thinking. You're with a philosophic perspective, you're thinking reflectively. Reflective thinking, spiritualized thinking, you know, basically synonyms, just, you know, speaking of the same thing in two different ways.
Really?
Right? So we're not talking about, you know, when I was talking about material consciousness and spiritual consciousness, you know, not that kind of spiritual, quote unquote, spiritualized thinking. That's kind of more just sort of spiritual thinking. This is spiritualized thinking. Your spiritualized mind is your mind in the upper domain of the hourglass analogy, right? Thinking more and more with that upper domain, less and less lower domain first, more and more upper domain first, right? So that you approach things more top-down. Okay?
On the inhabited worlds, the teacher sons become voluntary collaborators with the finaliters. And these same teacher sons also accompany the finaliters to the mansion worlds, when those spheres are no longer to be utilized as differential receiving worlds after an entire system has settled enlightened life. At least this is true by the time the entire constellation has thus evolved. But there are no groups that far advanced in Nebadon.
Okay. All right, so you got a couple things there again. You've got, again, a little bit more of, you know, they talked about before, when we're going through the worlds, you know, as individual worlds, the teacher sons having all kinds of roles because they're Trinity, right? Teacher sons. Here you're seeing a little bit more of the big picture. They're also starting to not just work with that world, but to help to facilitate this wholeness of the whole local system, right? Not just the wholeness of the world. Right, so they accompany the finalers to the mansion worlds. You know, when they finally, you know, roll up the ascending mortal sidewalks on the mansion worlds, right, when they cease to be used for ascenders anymore. Eventually, you're going to get to that point.
My promenade's gone.
and notice how they're giving you some clues about that. You could kind of imagine you got the whole local system settled in light and life. Remember how we were talking about on an individual world, you know, and a lot of beings are going straight to the local system headquarters, or the local universe headquarters. I mean, you know, when they when they die, and a lot of them are fusing, you know, to get there, you know, to boot. So you could say, well, you know, maybe there's no more ascenders that need the mansion worlds, you know. Not too far down the road, they're saying, well, yeah, technically, but at least this is true by the time the entire constellation is thus evolved. Okay. Right. So remember when we saw that, you know, they were pointing out, it's like, well, okay, now finally, you know, more people are reaching third circular. Okay. It takes a long, long time before every one of those worlds in that local system doesn't need the mansion worlds anymore. I mean, you know, there's a couple of individuals, you know, still, you know, that are still needing them, you know, for quite a while. Okay, but they're saying, yeah, but definitely by the time you get all 100 local systems in a constellation settled in light and life,
yeah,
right, everyone's mansion worlds have been recommissioned into new modes,
storage.
And not storage. they're not turned into closets, and you can see what they're being tasked for is things that have to do with a much bigger picture, right? You need the really, really big picture people to come in and start to take charge of what's going on there now. It's not just these lowly, you know, parochial ascender sorts of issues, you know, all very relative to that local system, et cetera, et cetera. So you need the finaliters and the Trinity teacher sons to get involved. in reforming the whole modality of those worlds, what they can't reveal, and partly you'll see why in the next little statement they make.
We are not permitted to reveal the nature of the work of the Finaliters, who will supervise such rededicated mansion worlds. You have, however, been informed that there are throughout the universes various types of intelligent creatures who have not been portrayed in these narratives.
Okay, so they can't tell you directly. They just gave you a clue, so put the pieces together. What can you deduce from that? Okay, what beings are not revealed in these narratives in general? Exactly. Beings that don't have anything to do with the ascension scheme. Right. The really big picture, going beyond just the one scheme, going to the other six schemes. Right. Right. I mean, obviously, the mansion worlds are very much just about the ascension scheme initially. Right. So when they're retooled, it has to do with those other six schemes that they're not allowed to tell us anything about in the revelation. And they start to retask those worlds relative to those other schemes.
Okay. Any speculation?
No, again, I mean that's all you can speculate, because, right, yeah. But you can go that far. See, but they weren't allowed to say that directly. But see, now they gave you everything. You just put the two pieces together.
On their way in from the first outer space level.
Well, not yet. It's not that yet. Right? We're not that far yet. So you don't have absentiators coming in from the outer space.
I'm saying that could be another scheme.
I mean, but eventually.
Oh, yeah.
Right, I mean, what are these, what's this, if the finaliters are involved, it's all oriented towards the grand universe being settled in light and life. So, yes, maybe you need to bring in the other six schemes so that you get a full seven scheme domain established there, and maybe then, when the grand universe is settled in light and life, this somehow works with absentiters coming in. Yes, you can speculate along those lines, right, because absentiters would have to come into a domain that has the full completeness. Not just one of the seven folds, right? It would have to have the full finite foundation that they would plant themselves upon, right? So you can speculate along those lines. But initially, it's just about all of these unrevealed beings, right? And there has to be beings that are down in the trenches like us relative to those other six schemes, right?
They even mentioned,
right.
I don't want to tell
them. So, betraying your trust. I mean, if the mansion worlds are they're heavy usage for ascenders is at the beginning, and then we kind of phase them out, then it must be people, or it could be people descending, because by the time we're about done using them, then they're getting to the point where they're going to start needing them more.
Right. So you could see this. You've got things like that. It's like, if you. Is there something that's descending in at least some of those other six schemes?
Okay.
That's a speculation you could make. They really don't give us much of the way of clues. The only real clue you've got is somehow getting very insightful in deducing the ramifications of having a different master spirit being a pattern behind it. Because remember, one of the seven schemes is dominant in each of the seven super universes. The ascension scheme is dominant in the seventh. Right. See, so that has some synchrony with the seventh master spirit, right, the seventh. So the other six schemes, have some primacy relative to the other six master spirits. So you got that one little bit of clue to work off of.
Yeah, very little.
But boy, that's right. that's a pretty limited starting point. You can extrapolate, pretty freely from such an unconstrained starting point. The fact that they remind us, in places like this of those other six schemes, says to me that way down the road, hundreds of years from now, if you've developed a lot of deductive consequences of what you have here, I bet you can start to have some pretty decent speculations about what those other schemes are, because you'd have a much better sense of what the wholeness is, and so you know what parts you need to have a whole.
Yeah.
And I say that because I've already, done this some, right? I mean, you start to get a recognition of the wholeness of the reflectivity mechanism, for instance, and you're unpacking the central universe, and you go, oh, that's what that part is for, right? I mean, you recognize you need certain parts to flesh out this wholeness you've recognized, and coincidentally, every one of those parts is mentioned somewhere in the book. It's like, oh, that's where the reflectivators go, and that's where the, qualified vicegerents go, et cetera, right? I mean, so most likely, so you can continue to do that. You finally get an insight, recognition. It's like, here's the wholeness of this. Okay, so there's going to need to be 5 parts, or 10 parts, or whatever, right? And you begin to be able to...
There's ascending suns in all universes.
Right.
I mean, Grand Fondo was the first one of the first universe.
Right.
So the ascension scheme must exist in those places.
Right, right.
So
the
other schemes exist here. We just
yes, yes, exactly. Right. The other, all 7 schemes are in each super universe. It's just one is dominant, only in a particular
right.
super universe.
We aren't recognizing the other 6 right now that are... Probably right in front of our eyes, but
we don't know if some of that is actually happening on our world. They couldn't reveal that if it was, or if it's happening on other worlds that aren't revealed. Remember, they do allude to other mysterious worlds that aren't like ours, and they don't explain what they're for in the Life Carrier paper. So yeah. That's kind of what I was shooting for, just these 2 seconds. But just recognize that always grab a hold of the low hanging fruit when they give it to you like that. I mean, they're just teeing it right up. They don't want you to go to the next paragraph. It's like I'll pause there for a second. Can you take it one more step that we're not allowed to directly say? Every sentence is a suggestion. Nothing is an end in this book. Everything in this book is a beginning. If you believe everything is an end, it's because you believe it's a sacred text. It's not a sacred text. Right? It's a metaphysics. It's an initial assumption. Right? And you got to start trying to at least take the first deductive steps. When they tee things up, it's like, okay, they say that, now what does that imply? Right? Start,
We don't know too much.
Don't just, carve the words in stone. Do something with them. Because the revelators tell you that's the only way you can validate the revelation. Revelation can only be validated experientially. Until you start trying to apply their initial assumptions, and there's nothing but initial assumptions, you haven't put it into practice. There's no way you've gotten some positive experiential feedback. It's like, wait a minute, this is actually working. This might actually be true, right? you gotta put it to the test. You gotta start working it. Juxtapose it with other things, attempting to refute it. It's like, well, okay, it implies this. Oh, well, that has a relevance over here. Oh no, that conforms with that. Try to let the moment you start applying it, you can bring things in to attempt to refute it and see if it's true. Until you've found that it withstands an extensive attempt to refute it, you have no idea if it's true or not. You can believe that, but who cares? You can believe anything. Anyone can believe this is true. The only way to validate it, like the revelators say, is to put it into practice.
Get real.
Truth is something you experience, not something you believe. Okay.
And now, as the systems one by one become settled in light by virtue of the progress of their component worlds, the time comes when the last system in a given constellation attains stabilization, and the universe administrators, the Master Sun, the Union of Days, and the Bright and Morning Star, arrive on the capital of the constellation to proclaim the Most Highs, the unqualified rulers of the newly perfected family of 100 settled systems of inhabited worlds.
And they're teeing up what they bring up more definitively in the next block. But remember, I've reminded of this many times. Why are they called the Most Highs? Because in truth they are Most High. And we're about to factualize that truth. Right? They factually are. Period. The Most High. And just the one other little thing is the time element. You know, they were teeing it up before about the at least this is true by the time the entire constellation is thus evolved. You know, think about that. They're telling you that, but there are no groups that far advanced in Nebadon. Okay, how far advanced are we in Nebadon? Right, the first inhabited worlds were how long ago in Nebadon? 200 billion years ago, right? And 200 billion years is not enough time for any mansion worlds that have gotten reworked. So.
Or any constellations to go into light and life, really. Is
what
So that would be 100 systems, right? Or 100,000 worlds?
So again, 200 billion years is not very long. Can't really get much of anything done in 200 billion years. All right? Is that the way you think about things? Right?
Yeah, when you think about it, 400 billion years ago that Jesus laid his plans to come out, he had to wait 200 billion years just to get to. Yeah, you're right. We're young.
Right, and so now remind yourself, especially post-spiritual uplift for the last 2,000 years, everyone's got an adjuster. There's no limit on how much of a recognition of ideals an adjuster can catalyze in your mind. You could very easily, in a sublime moment, get a vague recognition of an ideal that is relevant to a constellation being settled in light and life. Something that's not directly applicable for well beyond 200 billion years of time, right? That's how far in advance some of the ideals that you might be recognizing are. And so if you're applying something that, well, technically that's only appropriate 500 billion years from now, and you're trying to apply it right now, how catastrophic will that be to civilization? So, you know, when they're chanting, you know, what do we want?
Destiny.
When do we want it now? You know, it's possible you could be thinking something very remote, right? Transcending the current time scale of Nebadon to, 300 billion years. Okay? So we need to, that's why they're telling us these things. We've got to be reminded of this. We need to be very humble. Normally, you've got a lot more humility before you have a spiritual uplifter, right? We didn't even have a magisterial son. I mean, genetically, we have almost no inherent humility. And yet Michael came anyway as the spiritual uplifter and juiced us up, okay? So the disconnect there from what you can potentially visualize as an ideal and the fact of where and when you are can be extreme, right? All throughout the book they teach, it's not just here, I mean, everywhere, you know, you can see this. They try to remind you all over the place. You know, the Romans tried to do such and so, and it helped to bring about the collapse of the Roman Empire, and you see what they say, it's like, well, what's the big deal with that? That's just a little technicality. And isn't that an appropriate thing to do anyway? Yeah, eventually, but not then. You know, you do this little too idealistic transformation of the Mori system, your civilization collapses.
It's a good idea, but bad timing.
Right. Great, you know, ideal, right? But you've forgotten about the timing issue. Yeah. And it's really sad when, you know, even in our short lifetimes, you can see this happen. Now, you may have a close friend who identifies highly with ideals, and they got very passionate, and wanted to implement something now, and it produced calamity. And then you notice it, that thing that they wanted to do naturally came into play just 5 years hence, mm-hmm. and was totally stable, didn't cause any calamity. 5 years, right? And the personal suffering and heartache that was caused just because they couldn't wait 5 years, right? I mean, how sad is that? Right? Did we do that to ourselves? We've got to stop doing that. You know, no one is saying that your recognition of ideals is invalid. You just got to remind yourself of time. It's not a dichotomy. Don't beat yourself up. I mean, no human knows what the words idea and ideal even mean. Right? And it's not until the fifth epical revelation that we actually know the definitions of those words. So no wonder we don't keep them properly separated. They blur together. Right? We vaguely have the notion of an idea, but not the technical, precise, scientific definition of it the revelation gives you. And ideals we're just completely clueless on. Right? If you tell someone, you got to be careful about ideologies, because that's a very problematic thing. It's like, well, no, isn't that about ideals? No, that's about ideas that you falsely juiced up with your zeal. You don't even know the etymology of the word. It's like when Jesus came down. It's just like we are so confused about these things.
Like when Jesus came down from after the 40 days or whatever, and he said something like, he decided to quietly go about proclaiming the gospel and let God, it says, the thought adjuster, work out the details day by day. It's sort of like, as you were just saying, as opposed to think what was going on in his mind.
Be a humble servant, right? The whole, all Michael was trying to do is finally get himself completely, cooperatively subordinate to the Paradise Trinity. That was the whole point of his seven bestowals, and he's achieving, he's dotting the final I's and crossing the final T's of that subservience to the Paradise Trinity in his seventh bestowal, right? Completely eliminating any even potential for self-righteousness. Like, no, we are all subservient to the whole. Even creator parts are not transcendent of the whole. I am subservient to the whole. I am a part in a much greater context. Right? It doesn't matter if my mom and dad were literally the universal father and the eternal mother son. It doesn't matter. I'm still under the whole, just like mom and dad.
Did I not learn anything from them?
No. The whole determined when this hour came.
Yes. All right. The whole is the agent of Kairos. All right? Not any part. Yeah. Okay, we'll move on to the really huge transformations of how a whole administrative structure works in the next one. Things start to get really, really modified going forth from here. So let's take a moment here.